Erev Tov, Boker Tov, good evening, good afternoon, and welcome to another installment in our ongoing series of analysis of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. And as promised several times, tonight I'm going to present a somewhat different perspective than that presented in the earlier podcast, and indeed take a look at some of the same texts that we saw in earlier podcasts and look at them with a different eye. In order to present this shiur, I need to present, at the beginning, four premises upon which this shiur rests. Premise number one is about the text of the Haggadah. Now, the text of the Haggadah, truth to be told, is something of a work in progress. What I mean by that is that the core text of the Haggadah, as we find it in its first formulation, in the Mishnah and the Tosefta from the 2nd to 3rd centuries, includes some of the central pieces that make up our Haggadah, but leaves much out of it. For instance, the Mishnah tells us that Doresh Mi'arami Oved Avi, that you have to explain the four verses in Mikra Bikurim, the four verses in Deuteronomy 26, 5, 6, 7, and 8, and the more you do, the better it is, but it doesn't give us any particular text of Midrash to use, which very quickly became part of the standard Haggadah and appears in the earliest Haggadot that we have, Sadya, for the Rambam, etc. And indeed, many things that we consider to be, and I spoke about this in last night's podcast, many things that we consider to be relatively central in the Haggadah and essential to the Haggadah, such as Dayenu, only appear later on as alternative texts to be added in if one wishes, and only later on do they get mainstreamed into the text. However, the core text of the Haggadah as we have it, premise number one, is composed and put together. When I say put together, what I mean is that some of the texts are composed, and the putting together of biblical texts in that particular format is something that happened in the generations immediately after the destruction of the temple in the year 70 CE. This is something that is actually quite easy to demonstrate when you look through the Haggadah, particularly when we note the names of the rabbis that are associated with the various statements and the original sources of many of the statements. For instance, the famous passage of the four sons, we talked about in the podcast number 2 and 3, is originally sourced in the Mechilta, which is a 2nd century, 3rd century text. the Drashot of Rabbi Eliezer and Yosef Lili and Rabbi Akiva, of course, these are 2nd century Tanaim, late 1st century Tanaim, but after the destruction. Rabban Gamliel, who plays a central role, and we'll see his role tonight, is at the end of the 1st century. But indeed, much of the text that we have reflects a period after the destruction. Indeed, many scholars have maintained, and there is much to recommend this perspective, that the way that the Seder night went was very different when there was a temple around as opposed to afterwards, not just due to the contemporary absence of the Korban Pesach and the many things that were added in order to remember the Korban Pesach, the two cooked items of the meal, etc., but even the order of the meal. Tavori argues in his book Pesach Dorot and in several articles that he wrote that, and he's not the first one to argue this, that based on a careful reading of the Mishnah, it seems that in the times of the temple, the food was ingested first and only afterwards the discussion took place. And the discussion was chiefly around the symbolism of the food, by Megamliel's symbols. We'll get back to Megamliel's symbols as a core part of tonight's presentation. So that's premise number one. Premise number two is the notion of a polemic. A polemic, which literally means a war, it's a Greek word, polemos means war, develops as early as the rabbinic period into a word that means a verbal attack. It's a verbal attack, verbal parry, against a particular position. And the polemic is almost always internal, meaning it is a text or a presentation that remains within one group, attacking, perhaps even covertly, a position espoused by another group to maintain the, shall we say, the unity or the faith continuity of the group that is somewhat under attack. Now, the notion of a polemic is something that shows up throughout rabbinic writings in many, many different ways. And the polemic is a response to different sort of attacks that happen at different time periods and in different places. So, for instance, you will find overt polemics against the Sadducees during the end of the Second Temple period. You will find overt and covert, implicit and explicit polemics against the early Christians in writings, in statements that we have of the Tanaim and the Amoraim, chiefly in Eretz Yisrael. You will find polemics against Zoroastrianism in more Babylonian texts, etc. And, by the way, that doesn't stop there, because there are definitely Jewish polemic texts besides the out-and-out disputation texts, such as Sefer Nitzachon and the, say, the Vikuach of the Ramban, etc., famous disputations of the Middle Ages. Besides those, there are very clear polemic texts aimed at responding to attacks on Judaism from one corner or another. Indeed, one of the most famous works of Jewish thought of the Middle Ages, the Kuzari, authored by Rabbi Yehuda Levi, was a polemic. It was a defense of Judaism against the attacks by the Islamic philosophers. And so the notion of a polemic is something with which we're very familiar. And truth to tell, polemic texts do not begin in the rabbinic period. There are polemic texts that we have that go back as far as the Tanakh in the Bible. You have an overt polemic in the Bible against idolatry, left and right, making fun of it, demonstrating its silliness and its emptiness. For instance, a classic case is in the first book of Kings, chapter 18, Malachim Aleph Perek Yud Chet, the famous stand of Elijah the prophet, Eliyahu Navi, at Mount Carmel against the 850 prophets of the Baal that were associated with Ahab and Izebel. And they had the Gam competition where they each put an animal on their altar, and first the prophets of the Baal were to call to their god to make a fire come down from heaven and consume the offering. And when it didn't happen, Elijah made fun of them. Vayihatel b'hem, the text says. He teased them, he ridiculed them, and he said, call out a little louder, maybe your god is asleep, maybe he's out for a walk. Clearly poking fun at their very silly and errant beliefs. That's not the only polemic. There are many polemics against idolatry which are a little bit less obvious to the untrained eye. For instance, in this one is a little more obvious than some of the others. We'll go from more obvious to less obvious. In the first book of Samuel, chapter 5, there is a relatively short chapter which describes the interactions, as it were, of the Ark as it came into Philistine territory and went from city to city, and everywhere it went, it wreaked havoc, but it began in Ashdod in the temple of Dagon. Dagon is the fish god. Remember, the Philistines are a seafaring people, and they had a fish god, and the Ark was brought to stand in front of Dagon as a sign that Dagon's people had beaten the Ark's people. The Philistines had beaten the Israelites, and of course that meant that Dagon was stronger than the Ark in that sort of thinking. And the next day the people came in and they found Dagon bowing before the Ark, and their immediate response was, oh, it's a mistake, it's a happenstance, they put it back up. The next day they found that Dagon's hands, whatever Dagon looked like, the hands were cut off and they were sitting on the threshold and the head was cut off. And they not only reassembled it, but from that day on, nobody would touch the threshold because it was sanctified, because Dagon's cut-off hands had rolled there. Well, clearly, the text is underscoring these points to show how silly and how empty this the kind of thinking that that animates the followers of Dagon was. Now, there are far more implicit polemics that exist that one has to be familiar with external texts to understand. So, for instance, the Midrash Rabbah in the third century piece, fourth century piece, perhaps, commenting on the verse "Vayivarech Elohim et Yom HaShviʼi Kadesh Oto," that Genesis chapter 2 verse 3 says that God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it. The very big question that everybody has is, what kind of blessing does God give to the Shabbat before there's anyone around to commemorate it? And so a particular Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani says in the name of his teacher, Rabbi Yonatan, that's a second century teacher, says that every other holiday can be moved from day to day. It can happen on any day of the week. Not any day of the week, but in those days it could happen on any day of the week. Shabbat is never moved. Now, you read the text. It's vaguely interesting. Until you look at the backdrop of the polemic between Judaism and Christianity, where under Paul's direction, Shabbat was moved to the Day of the Lord, as they called it, which was Sunday. And so the polemic was, no, the blessing of Shabbat is that Shabbat will never be moved. And you, who have changed it to Sunday, you are in error. Similarly, the same rabbi, Shmuel bar Nachmani, in the same work Midrash Rabbah, is quoted as saying the following. When God said to Moshe, to Moses, write down in the Torah, first day of creation, the second day of creation, etc. When he got to the sixth day of creation, he said, write down what God said, which was, let us make man in our image. Plural is critical. And Moses turned to God in the Midrash. The words are put into Moses' mouth and says, you are giving ammunition to the sectarians. Now, which sectarians are there? What other people are there that revere the text of the Bible and nonetheless believe in some form of polytheism that would love to look at this text and say, aha, you see, there are multiple gods. They're talking to each other and making God and making man together. Well, the answer is quite obvious. It's the Christians. And this is later Christians. This is already second and third century Christians who have adopted many pagan approaches to polytheism as opposed to the strict monotheists of the first century. And so that's the response. And by the way, God's response to Moses is, you write what I tell you. Anybody who wants to make a mistake, let him make a mistake. But you understand that what's happening is that the rabbis are putting into Moses' mouth a response to the problem that exists in their time with Christians. And it's a polemic against Christianity, but it's one that is veiled. And one has to get a sense of the time period and what else was going on. But that's something that is not limited to rabbinic writings. That appears in the Torah also. And I'll briefly give an example of it and then move on. There are contemporary texts to the Torah, meaning from the second millennium BCE, that describe creation of the world, describe the flood story, etc. And as I say, etc., some of those basic stories, obviously they don't have a story about Yetziat Mitzrayim, about the Exodus, they don't have a story about the giving of the Torah. There are stories that are rooted chiefly in Mesopotamia, and have these mythic descriptions of things that we also find parallels to in the Torah. However, one of the chief things that happens at the beginning of these books, nearly all of them, is they begin with what we call a theogony. A theogony is sort of a life history or a family record of the gods. So this god was interested in that goddess, and he fought off that god to be able to be with that goddess, and they got together, and they had little gotskalas, and one of the gotskalas was stronger than the others, and they forced him, and he forced them, and then somebody created the world. Which means that there's a whole bunch of premises that happen before the creation of the world, and that is, first of all, multiple gods and human attributes, etc. And ultimately, that the one who creates the world is doing it because of some sort of manipulation on the part of the other gods. It's not his free will. You open up the Torah and you read the first verse, Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And that's it. There's only one God. There's no theogony. It doesn't have parents. It doesn't have brothers, sisters. There's no jealousy, etc. And he creates of his own free will. And the God speaks and it happens. And that's it. Well, when read in isolation, it becomes, shall we say, a program for belief. When read in context, it suddenly becomes also a polemic text, which is responding to the common beliefs at the time about the nature of God and about God's relationship to the world and God's free will, etc. And it's making a very point-blank statement. One other very quick example is that it is commonly known that there were sects in Mesopotamia during the second millennium BCE that worshipped snakes. And you open up the third chapter of Bereshit, of Genesis, and you see that the snake becomes the root of all evil. Not only that, but the snake is punished. God has absolute dominion over the snake. The snake is not a competitor to God. God says, off with your legs, that's it. God says, you can eat dust, that's it. And therein lies a very strong polemic against that sect in Mesopotamia. Now, that doesn't mean that that is the sum total and some significance of the stories, and that's something I'm going to get to in the next premise. The next premise about polemics is that polemics are not untrue. A polemical statement, it may be untrue, but a polemic statement is not necessarily untrue, and nearly always in Torah writing, meaning in Torah, in the written Torah, in rabbinic literature, nearly always a polemic, and there are a couple notable exceptions, a polemic reflects a truth, but a truth that did not need to be expressed or explicated in another circumstance because it was not a truth that was under threat. I'll give a quick example of this to something that really will open up a can of worms we'll deal with in some later podcast, perhaps. But there has been much talk over the last few years about the issue of a catechism in Judaism, the notion of Judaism maintaining a list of beliefs that one has to subscribe to. And this, of course, revolves around the Rambam's famous list, which he put together in his commentary to the Mishnah in the introduction to the last chapter, or second to last chapter, in Masechet Sanhedrin, the famous 13 principles of faith. You take a look at these 13 principles, and you realize that it certainly is the case that mainstream Judaism has, for the last 800 years, certainly, if not before, accepted each one of those things as a basic principle of faith. But what's interesting is there are other things that Jews accept as principles of faith that aren't listed there. And especially Maimonides himself, who put the list together, has a very important principle that he left out, and that is the principle of free will. Take a look at the Rambam in Hilchot Tshuva, chapter 5, for instance, and he points out how absolutely significant and central the notion of free will is, and yet it appears nowhere on his list. So why is that? Well, look carefully at the list, and you realize that the list is a responsive list, or a reactive list, meaning that every one of the items on that list is something that in the Rambam's time or before, and that point is very important, in the Rambam's time or before was a belief that was being challenged either internally or externally, but externally is a little asterisk to it, and we'll get to that in the last premise in a moment. And that is as follows. For instance, the first premise that to believe in the Creator and there is none before him, etc., that is a response, of course, to a sort of a general faith statement. But when you start talking about the faiths, the principle that there's only one God, well, that's an immediate response to the Trinity. When you talk about the idea that Moses' prophecy is superior in quality to all of the prophets, that's a response both to Christianity and to Islam, who maintain that they had the final prophet, as it were. To maintain that the Torah that we have in our hands is exactly the same Torah that Moses himself got. By the way, Maimonides himself could never really believe that because he writes in the 8th chapter of Hilchot Sefer Torah about how all the texts that we have today are corrupted and they don't agree with each other. Of course, what he meant was that the substance of the text is the same. That's a response to Islam that maintained, and it was a very important piece in Islam, that the Jews had forged the text of the Torah and switched around Isaac and Ishmael, etc. And so the Rambam is expressing those basic beliefs of Judaism that are true and real beliefs of Judaism, but that have currently come under attack from within or from near. And that's the next and the last premise. And therefore, they need to be explicated. What that means is that a text which is polemical is not an untrue text. It is not reflecting a statement that the author himself doesn't really believe. And again, there are some exceptions to this. But generally, it does not express that. Rather, it expresses a belief that everyone understands to be central to, in our case, to Judaism, but that never had to be expressed because we were in a group that all accepted it. Once it becomes challenged, then it needs to be expressed. This has a wonderful salutary effect on the readers and the engagers in that text. That is that a notion that up until now was perhaps viscerally felt and perhaps intuitively understood, but not formally expressed. Now that it becomes formally expressed, in a sense, there is a real distillation, crystallization, and refinement of belief, because now we've expressed something that up until now we didn't need to express, and now it's taken on form. So again, the first three premises, the first premise, of course, is a historic premise, which again can easily be demonstrated, and that is that the core text of the Haggadah as we have it, or the composition of that text, is post-destruction. The second thing is that the notion of a polemic, it's not really a premise, but just an observation of the notion of polemic going back as far as the first verse of the Torah and all the way through contemporary times. Just a quick example. In the 19th century, much of the literature that was being written by Orthodox rabbis was aimed, in some cases, obviously, and in some cases, you had to read between the lines to see it, but was being aimed at the Reform movement. or was being aimed at Wissenschaft, the enlightenment. In the 20th century, in the middle of the 20th century, much of the literature that was being written in the Orthodox world was being written as a response to the threat of conservative Judaism at that point. And then there was that response. Today, neither one of those groups is really being addressed in mainstream Orthodox circles because the divide is very far. And that brings us to the fourth premise. The fourth premise is that a polemic will only be a response to a group that is near enough to be a threat. And that is as follows. If Buddhists somewhere on the other side of the world make a claim about what God is or what God isn't, Judaism doesn't feel the need to respond. Jewish leaders don't respond. An individual Jew may be intrigued by what's written and take it up, but there's not going to be a response. If, however, let's say somebody who believes in the Bible, a Christian who believes in the Bible, makes a claim about what the Bible says, and he's a Bible scholar, makes a claim about what the Bible says, and it's a claim that we know is not a true, it's not just not reflecting accurately what the Bible says, depending on what circles the individual Jewish leader may be integrated with, he may feel a need to respond and say, look, we all believe in this, the holiness of this text. Of course, we approach it very differently. But even from a very standard approach to the text, you're representing it wrong. You're misrepresenting it. He'll feel the need to speak out. But that's really a rare occurrence. But a far more common occurrence is if somebody else who was a co-religionist and who was in part of the same faith camp makes a statement, permits that which is prohibits that which is permitted, makes a statement about something which we believe to be an error and which violates the spirit of the tradition, called Ruach Yisrael, as it were, then suddenly there is a need to take up arms and to respond. And of course, in our day, that taking up arms is very group specific, which means if there's a particular group that has much interaction with particular what are called Haredi circles, there's no better word for it. Right wing doesn't mean anything, but particular circles. And within those circles, certain statements are made that are not reflective of what the group really believes, then the group will come out and say so. For instance, a few months ago, when some people who put on a disguise and pretended to be religious Jews went to Iran and spoke to our enemies and befriended them and said all sorts of terrible things, so people who were outside of that camp were just disgusted but didn't feel a need to distance themselves. It was clear that they were distanced. However, other members of Naturae Karta came out and put a very clear protest and said these guys don't represent us and what they're doing is wrong, etc. And so similarly did other groups that are generally allied with an anti-Zionist stance. So the closer you are to the threat, the more the threat really hits you and forces you not only to express publicly, but also to internally think about and formulate a position which is different. Okay, so those are the four premises. Premise number one, when the Haggadah was composed. Premise number two, the notion of polemic. Premise number three, the fact that polemic is not an external statement, but is chiefly a distillation of and crystallization of belief. Premise number four, which is that a polemic is always a threat from something which is close. Now, there is an exception to that last rule, and that is when we are formally being threatened and are under the gun for a response. And that was the case in the disputations in the Middle Ages. By the time the Middle Ages rolled around, Christianity was no longer an ideological threat to Judaism, because the divide between the two was so vast, not only religiously, but also sociologically and in every which way, in power structure way, that that there was no concern that anybody in the Jewish community would confuse the two, one for the other. There, Jews were forced to respond to Christianity because the other choice to, or the alternative to responding was usually death or a huge ransom or exile or sometimes combinations of those three. And therefore, they felt the need to respond. But that's a very different cry than what a traditional polemic is. So the polemic is always going to be geared towards the group that is close at the time. And therefore, in the Second Temple period, there's a response to the Hellenists. And later on, there is a polemic against the Sadduki, the Sadducee. There are laws that were formulated, the Mishnah and Parah, the Mishnah and Menachot. There are laws that were formulated by the rabbis as a response to the claims of the Sadducees. Later on, for instance, in the 8th and 9th centuries, the challenge comes from the Karaites, That challenge was around for a couple hundred years. The Karaites are still here, but they're not here as a challenge anymore because nobody confuses them. At a later point in history, Sabbateanism, in a very different way, became a threat. The Enlightenment became a threat. And in particular circles, other forms of traditional Judaism became a threat. So that is the notion of a polemic. Why am I bringing this whole thing up in the context of the Haggadah? Because I think it can fairly well be substantiated, and we're going to leave this for a second part of this shiur, because the introduction indeed it took him nearly all the whole half hour, although I hope that that you have enjoyed it and have benefited from it. And so I will just give a sketch out what we're going to do in the next session, which will be the final session of these podcasts, and will be put out hopefully Saturday night or early on Sunday, well before we come to the Seder table. That the chief concern, and I already alluded to this with a couple of Rashim that I mentioned, the chief challenge to Judaism in the end of the first century through the second and third centuries in Eretz Yisrael specifically, the chief challenge to Judaism that necessitated a polemic response, which again helped to distill and crystallize who we are, came from the early Christians. And just a couple examples of how this shows up in rabbinic literature. Example one. The Mishnah in Tamid tells us that the Kohanim, who would have some sort of a prayer service while they were working in the temple every day, as part of that prayer service, they would have a public reading of the Decalogue, the commonly miscalled Ten Commandments, not Ten Commandments, but the Ten Statements, the Aseret HaDvarim. They would have them read out loud. And the Gemara quotes in several places that, and quotes several examples of how there was an attempt to do the same thing outside of the temple. In other words, after the destruction of the temple, to replicate this by having the daily service in the Beit Knesset, in the synagogue, be include the public reading of the Decalogue. And it was canceled and negated because of Ta'rumat HaMinim, the claims of the Minim. Who are the Minim? The Minim are, hands down, throughout rabbinic literature, nearly always referred to the early Christians. What was the claim? Because a very important claim in Pauline Christianity is that the only part of the law that was given to us directly by God was the Ten Statements. Everything else was made up by other leaders, and therefore we can interpret it metaphorically, and that's how the law pretty much ends up taking a back seat and a sharp left turn off of practice in Christianity by the end of the first century. As such, the rabbis were not willing to have us celebrate our tremendous connection to the Ten Statements, which we have a tremendous connection. Those are the words we heard directly from God, according to some Rishonim. Those are the words that were engraved on the tablets that sat inside the Aron HaKodesh. Obviously, we have a great, tremendous connection to those Ten Statements, and yet they would not allow them to be read publicly because it would give ammunition, as it were, to our very near threat, which were the early Christians, to claim, aha, you see, this is the only part that's from God. By the way, this plays out, and this is an important point about how polemics develop. Once a statement or position has been crystallized and has been put from the internal, visceral, intuitive sense into a formal, expressed, almost codified sense, it can never be rolled back. And as such, statements that perhaps were made in a particular time due to needs of polemic, true statements, of course, but due to needs of polemic, remain on the books. And as such, the Rambam, Maimonides in the 12th century, who was asked by a particular community, we always have the custom in our community, this is the phrasing of the question, we always have the custom in our community to sit for the public reading of the Ten Statements when we get to that part in the Torah reading. And a new rabbi has come to town and said that we should stand up. What should we do? And the Rambam said, you are right. You should stay seated. You're not allowed to stand up for that. And he quoted the passage in the Talmud that said that they did not even allow the public reading of the Ten Statements outside of the Beit HaMikdash because of the claims of the Christians. Now, these claims would no longer be brought up. And by the 12th century, whatever Christians there may have been in the community that the Rambam was writing to, the Maimonides was writing to, would not have come and claimed, ah, you see, you agree with us about the Ten Statements. It wasn't going to happen. But the point is that once distillation and crystallization of belief becomes formalized through a polemic statement, That statement can never be rolled back, which is a very important preface to what we're going to do in the next podcast, in the context of the Haggadah Shel Pesach. The thesis that I'm going to suggest is that the Haggadah Shel Pesach, in a very large way, and not only the text of the Haggadah, but the commentaries on the Haggadah, serve a polemic purpose, which is far greater than just a polemic. They serve a polemic purpose which actually helps us generation after generation to define who we are, not only in relation to the other, who we are in relation to ourselves, in relation to God, in a way that every generation becomes clearer and clearer as we run through more challenges to that. We will look at in the next podcast is several texts within the Haggadah that are difficult, that carry some challenges with them, and then once we interpolate the notion of polemic into that text as a subtext, then suddenly they become clear, and the statements there become actually quite audacious and very interesting. Everyone should have a Shabbat Shalom, and the final podcast will come after Shabbat.